This is Entrepreneurs the Playbook, where I give you access each week to the world's greatest athletes and executives about their personal and professional playbook and what has made them champions on and off the field.
Yankees win!
That contract extension was for $176 million.
Touchdown! And a title for the Patriots!
I can't believe it!
I'm your host and CEO of Sports One Marketing, David Meltzer. This is Dave Meltzer, CEO of Sports One Marketing, and I am here with one of my mentors. And this man's name is Dan Dillon. He is the president of the famous Olympic Club here in San Francisco. We're sitting in his office, and this will be a very lively playbook because this guy is kind of like, if you remember, the coach of Boise State with all the trick plays. I think Dan Dillon has a lot up his sleeve, and we're going to find out not only a lot about Dan, the Olympic Club, but also what's going on in the future here at the Olympic Club, which is really exciting. Well, Dan, welcome to the playbook.
Thank you for having me, Dave. This is fun. He calls me a mentor, but he's actually someone I look up to, so I guess we got a mirror on the ceiling or something that we're both aiming at. But I'm a big fan of Dave Meltzer, so I'm honored and thrilled to be asked to be a part of this.
I got to understand Dan's background's a lobbyist, so most likely I've already paid him. So any of these comments have to be taken with
I got
to
check the invoices.
Exactly. Invoices. Well, anyway, Dan, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became the president of the Olympic Club.
Well, you know, the Olympic Club is the oldest athletic club in America, and 1860, which we all take great pride in, and we rub it in the nose of probably far too often other clubs. But I grew up in the coal mining hills of Eastern Kentucky. I didn't ever think that something like this was in my future, including like even being invited to visit.
I grew up in Akron, you grew up in Kentucky.
Yeah.
What was in your head that you could never be the president of something like this?
Look, I mean, my grandfathers were both coal miners who came over from Ireland. And so I'm a second generation American, but I was given, do you remember S&H Green Stamps?
Yeah.
Remember those?
Yeah.
Well, I was given S&H Green Stamps golf clubs and got to play on a 9-hole golf course in Moorhead, Kentucky, and the pro would let us kids play so long as there were no adults that had a tee time. And if the adults had a tee time, we would take like a grocery bag and a 2-iron and go up in the woods and look for balls. That way we could have golf balls, killing rattlesnakes and copperheads along the way. My parents and grandparents wanted to make sure that I got out of the coal mining hills, but that's what I grew up with. So, you know, I remember the days when you would turn on the television on Saturday and Sunday and you would watch the last 6 holes of a PGA Tour event. So those—
Now, who was your favorite golfer at that time?
Johnny Miller.
That's easy.
Johnny Miller. Because I was 12 when he won the U.S. Open with that 63 on the final day, and I watched it. And
where was the U.S. Open played?
Oakmont.
Yeah,
I won't ever forget that. And I've gotten to know him a little bit since then, which has just been an absolute thrill. But the we couldn't see outside of the coal mining hills because you just couldn't. So to end up in California, to end up in San Francisco, to get invited one day to go play the Olympic Club was all pretty amazing to me. And then to get invited to be a member and then eventually to become president was beyond my wildest dreams. It's the biggest thrill of my life. And I can't even describe what
Speechless.
A great thrill it's been.
Yeah. What do you think it was that brought you to this point that, you know, and that is a incredible for, you know, growing up in Akron, Ohio, I understand you're limited by that vision of, wow, can I ever even leave the railroad track part of it, right? Past Firestone when I grew up. And then all of a sudden I remember the first time I was invited to a country club, right? I'm sure you felt the same way, right? Let alone the Olympic Club.
And what do I wear?
Right. What do you think the personality traits or your playbook, let's say, that really, because I'm so attracted to you, you know, in all kinds of ways, not to embarrass you, but you know, and you are like a magnet. The first time I met you, you know, and all the people that you attract, and I sit here at the Olympic Club and watch you, and everyone lights up when they see you light up a room yourself. What personality traits are that you possess that created these opportunities for you?
Well, like Dave Meltzer, who I am welcoming as a brand new member of the Olympic Club.
Oh, it's on tape. This is official.
I don't know what those are, and I think it'd be arrogant to, you know, it's certainly not my height or my hairdo, but I think that, you know, if your family, and I think it starts with family, but some people do it without family, but if you... If you have faith in yourself and you believe beyond the horizons that are presented to you, I think that if you aspire to things that are bigger than you can see in front of you, you can make it. You just gotta work toward it. I didn't have a playbook. I certainly didn't have a playbook, and I don't believe that Dave Meltzer did either. Mm-hmm. I believe that Akron, Ohio, and Moorhead, Kentucky, are not too far apart. But I do think that it doesn't take – you don't have to wake up in the morning and say, I'm special, I'm better than everybody else, I'm going to make this work. I think that you have to say to yourself, I'm special, I want more, and I will pursue it. And that doesn't mean at the expense of other people, but it just means that I'm not satisfied – with what I believe my lot in life to be. I want bigger things, and I'm going to figure it out. And like you, I didn't pursue a straight path.
Right. Now, would you say it's fair? Because, I mean, obviously, your humility is something that I admire, and I try to emulate myself. But moreover, you're someone that gives of others. How did that play a role? Because you know you're special, but you don't want to project that onto others. But I think you have a great ability of making others feel special and helping them achieve their goals in order to achieve your own. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Well, I it goes back to having parents and grandparents who wanted me to get out of the situation that they and we were in as a family. And so I always watched my father credit others maybe for things that he had done or whatever. When I was a handicapped kid, I was in a wheelchair and on crutches. And when in 1972, I walked precincts on crutches to campaign for Richard Nixon.
Wow. So
in Eastern Kentucky, how old were you? Couldn't be a Republican in Eastern Kentucky. And I had brochures that they sent to me from like
and how old
Louisville.
Were you? How old
I was
were
11.
You? 11 years old on crutches. What disease did you have?
I had a thing called Perthes disease. Uh-huh. So I didn't walk from – I was in a wheelchair or on crutches until I was about 11 or so. And so I was probably well enough to walk, but I thought it might get more votes if I put the crutches back on when I was 11. So I precinct walked for Nixon in 72, and gave out the brochures. But the thing was that I learned very early that the best, what I consider one of the great leadership traits that I've seen in people that I consider to be good leaders, is that you. You don't need the mic, you don't need the pat on the back, and you don't need the spotlight. You give it to others, and they know that they got it from you, then you scored. And that's, to me, a sign of leadership is to be able to discount, at least publicly, discount your own role. Give it to other people. Let them have it. Let them score. Let them go home at night with a beam in their eye when they look in the mirror, and to have their spouse or partner or best friend or whatever it is to look at them and say like, wow, you did well. That, because if you're a real leader, you don't need it. You know you're the leader.
Right.
Stop. It's not about you anymore. Let other people take credit.
That's awesome. No, you are one of, you know, I've been blessed to be around Lee Steinberg, who's known as a great negotiator. You are a great negotiator. You're a great lobbyist. People come to you all the time beyond this club to get things done. And presidents of the United States come to you, and others have you go to the presidents of the United States to get things done. I want to know, what's your art of negotiation? Like, where does that happen? Some people do it by bullying, others, you know, by being abundant. Where is the Dan Dillon playbook of negotiation?
I've never been asked that, but I would say that, never been asked that. I would say
you're so good at it.
Well, I think that without giving away what I've just negotiated, I think that you allow the people on the other side of the table to put on the table what they want and give them as much leeway and pat them on the back as much as they want to hear. And don't disrespect them. You've got to allow them to you have to understand that people on the other side of the table in a negotiation, I'm not talking about just like a real estate deal, and those are very important, but if someone is reporting back to an organization, you have to understand that they have to deliver back to their constituency either a delivery mechanism or a result, and they have to be able to defend what they brought back. So respect is a key element in negotiation, because you have to allow them to say, wow, we didn't get what we wanted, but here's why. And so I've watched Dave Meltzer work as well. I think that respecting the people across the table is as important as what you have in front of you item-wise.
And we talk about respect. In fact, I think our relationship was built on respect the first time that we met. There was an opportunity where some large agencies and others were involved, and part of the thing that you expressed to me was not only the respect that our company gave to you, but the individuals that came up. Where did that message come from of respect? Was that a childhood thing from your grandparents, parents, or was it something that evolved through negotiation?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I think that I did. I went in 1992. I was working for a public relations firm here in San Francisco, and I had an 8 a.m. meeting with one of the most famous names in San Francisco, real estate wise, and I was on time. My boss, and I was honestly almost immaterial to the meeting, but my boss, he showed up late, and he showed up about 20 minutes late. And so about 15 minutes after I was there, 5 minutes before the boss got there, this guy calls me in and he says, "Hey, Dan, you know, appreciate you being here on time. You guys are fired."
The guy literally fired. Yep.
Yeah, my boss wasn't even there yet.
Oh my!
The guy didn't even showed up.
Oh my gosh!
So he goes, "You guys are fired." And he says, "But I want you to know why." He says, "It has nothing to do with you. You were here on time. You showed respect." He goes, "But if your boss thinks that his time's mine more important than mine, I don't need him."
Right.
He goes, "Now, if you want to quit working for your boss and come to work for me, I got room for you," which I didn't do.
Wow.
But
did you think about it?
I should have. But however, there's a respect level, and I've never forgotten that, because I was so embarrassed and everything. I've never forgotten that. But let me say that Dave, and I'm not pandering to you, but what I've watched you do with your firm and the people I've watched you nurture, some in this room, and your generosity with your time is some people have to learn lessons the hard way. I learned the value of being on time the hard way. Right. My boss didn't show up. I've watched you nurture people, and I appreciate and respect that about you.
I appreciate that. What biggest mistake did you make? I know your boss made that mistake. If you know all the people that listen to this podcast, they like to hear what I call the dummy tax. And I've made tons of mistakes, and I know you illuminate, and you're just so humble and funny about self-deprecation like me, right? That's, we have that in common. We're both kind of the same stereotypical. Right, I love it. But what's your biggest mistake that you made?
You know, I can't pinpoint one because it's a very long list.
Well, give me one. Then.
Well, I would say that if I had to pick one, it would be one of those kind of things where I didn't know. So I'd been asked, and I'm not going to name any names, but I'd been asked to meet with somebody. And I thought, oh, man, this guy's always asking me to meet with people, and it's killing me over here. And then I ended up blowing it off. And I blew it off because I was having more fun at lunch with a mutual friend of ours. And
at least I wasn't involved with this.
You didn't even know about it.
Usually, biggest mistakes involve either me or somebody I know. So this is good. We're already right there.
Yeah,
that's
but
good.
You know, you had nothing to do with this.
All right.
And I blew this person off, who turned out to be a big shot, and I didn't know the name because I'm not in the tech world, and I probably left. I at least left, I don't know, six figures on the table in terms of fees to our firm in hindsight. And I know that that cannot be recouped.
That's an expensive beer at lunch with one of your friends.
Yeah. I mean, it was a glass of rosé. But I think that the lesson I learned was that, yes, many requests and people will – be not necessarily a waste of your time, but a burden on your time. But there's that one, and I blew that one, and I won't ever let myself. I'm not gonna like look in the mirror every day and stab myself. But I learned a lot from that, and I also from that learned that if a friend asks for a few minutes for someone, whether it's a college kid that needs a an informational interview, or a just a friend that needs a piece of advice, you're better off. And I'm not talking about the financial loss. I'm talking about just being a human being. I woke up feeling horrible, not because of the money lost, because I might not have made any money off of it.
Right.
I know there was an opportunity there. I might not have made any money off of it, and it shouldn't be the motivation anyway. We should be paying forward and helping people, grow themselves. But I woke up the next day feeling horrible. Again, not because of the money, but because someone asked me for a favor to help a youngster, and I didn't, and that is my biggest regret, that I left some youngster on the sideline. Honestly, I hope he ends up being rich as Bill Gates and kicking me in the butt one day, going, "Hey, you could have been on this train and you didn't get on." So I will never do that again. When I get a request, as busy as I might be, for a youngster to get a piece of advice or a few moments of my time, the answer is yes. Because I won't ever do that again.
I agree. I have a rule, right? All my calls, I always say, and I brand myself this way with all of our staff, that I'll give anybody 5 minutes on the phone. Because I know that I can make a difference in 5 minutes, but it also allows me to qualify the opportunities, right? I won't miss out on that as well. And then if someone's willing to take the time to come in and meet me in person, Then I limit it to 20 minutes. And so, you know, I'll give them. But the neat thing is when you brand yourself that way, people truly are prepared when they come to see you. So it almost puts an emphasis on being prepared, being organized. So, you know, my staff's, they're trained to say, oh, well, Mr. Meltzer only will have 5 minutes to talk to you, but he's more than happy to help. So make sure you have your ask. He would be more than happy to help you, but you can't waste time, you know, with pleasantries. And I really like it because I can now take, you know, literally, sometimes I do, 12 calls in an hour, where that's like 3 days of phone calls for some people that just like to talk about nothing. Well, coming into the final question, and this is an easy one for you, you know, we have this legacy. That's okay.
Sorry about that.
We're in live, so
yeah, I don't know how to make that stop.
I don't know either. We can cut. Yeah, that'll cut. That's fine. So coming to the final, we like to talk about a legacy, and there's several things about being the president of the Olympic Club, but also for your legacy. I know that you have a couple big golf tournaments that and hopefully we'll be working with you side by side fighting.
Yes, you will.
But tell us about the two biggest, I think, cornerstones or jewels in your legacy that you're going to be working on coming up in the future.
Well, I don't mean to make it too long, and you can always
cut it out.
The Olympic Club has a 62-year history with the United States Golf Association, and we take great pride in that. We've held 5 U.S. Opens. We've held 3 amateurs and a bunch of other amateur events. They came to us and asked us to host the 2021 Women's Open, which we are hosting and we're proud of. Today, they announced the 2023 Women's Open will be at Pebble Beach. So the USGA has gotten it right. They are taking the level of their Women's Open courses to the top. And I love that because I've got Christy Kerr and Morgan Presser are like sisters to me. I mean, I'm fired up about the Women's Opens. We had a long conversation with the USGA about the 2027 Men's Open. At the same time, the PGA of America approached us about the PGA Championship for 28 and the 32 Ryder Cup. A number of factors played in, but and finance is one of them. But the Ryder Cup is the world's biggest golf event. There's no question. It's the biggest golf event. And so our board took a look at it. We negotiated with the USGA. We didn't like the way it was going. We signed up to take the 28 PGA Championship, 2032 Ryder Cup. It's taking golf and golf events.
Both. You took both.
Yeah, we took both.
Wow.
And this is it's the biggest stuff in golf. We couldn't be more excited. And San Francisco is a great place for it. And if you look at next year, 2018, the Ryder Cup's in Paris. 2022, it's in Rome. I mean, this is no longer backwoods, you know, big golf clubs in small markets. So we're, you know, Rome, Paris, San Francisco, we're thrilled to be able to announce it and excited to be able to host it. You know, I'll be honest, the club's going to make a lot of money, but beyond that, it's a, it's the biggest event in golf. And we feel like we've earned it. After 5 U.S. Opens and those kinds of things. And we feel like we've earned the chance, the opportunity to host it. And San Francisco's earned the chance to host it. And I couldn't be more excited. I've worked on this for 10 months. I'm proud as I can possibly be of it. And, you know, can't wait to bring the world of golf and the biggest event in golf to the Olympic Club.
Well, it's an honor to, number one, be your newest member.
Yes, he is.
That's odd, Bill. But more importantly, to be your mentee. And, I mean, talk about a legacy. Just to bring those tournaments to this course. And I know you're a part of this establishment. You took a year off of work in order to be the president of the Olympic Club. And to get this done is incredible. And I think, you know, I can't wait to be there with my son, who by, you know, 32 is going to be in college. Hopefully at Stanford or Berkeley.
Hopefully playing golf. Are still around.
Maybe he'll be playing for the Ryder Cup, right? Yeah. Playing golf at Stanford or Berkeley. He's been playing since he's three, and he's a much better athlete than his dad, which isn't saying much. But, you know, this has been just an incredible journey. And for the playbook, although you say you don't have a playbook, your life, that journey can be utilized for others as a playbook. And I really respect you, Dan, and I really appreciate you. And I think everybody here does. And, you know, some people speak with your words. When you speak with your words, it's usually, like I said, humble, self-deprecating, extremely funny and fun. But your actions are that of a grand champion, of a true mensch, as they say. And so I just want to say thank you for being on the playbook. This is Dan Dillon, the president of the Olympic Club and the man who brought the Ryder Cup to San Francisco in the Olympic Club, here with Dave Meltzer, CEO of Sports One Marketing, on Entrepreneurs, the Playbook. Be sure to tune in next Monday, where we feature another story on how a sports icon went from the playing field to the boardroom.